Bryan, Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding, case number A-19-1261, State of Minnesota, respondent versus Ziddy Taylor, appellant.
Good morning, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Court of Appeals via WebEx, and I'd like to start by having each of the other two judges say something, at least let us know that they can hear what I'm saying. So why don't I start with you, Judge Riley. How is the technology on your end this morning?
It's slow in rural Hennepin County, but I think it'll work fine. And I will just say, if at any time you can't hear me, put your hand to your ear or something like that, so I'll know. But I'm going to mute so Judge Johnson can weigh in.
So far, I can see and hear everyone just fine. Thank you.
All right. And counsel, Ms. Rankin.
Good morning. I can see and hear just fine. Thanks.
Ms. Bokes.
Thank you. I can also see everyone and hear everyone fine at this point.
And I don't know if, counsel, you've had a chance to do these kind of arguments yet, but if not, there has been, I'll say one other thing, and that is that there's, we have our clock in one of the screens. So if you can't see it, it may be because you're in a view that has the active speaker blown up on your screen. And if instead you click to this grid view, you should all, it's in the top right-hand corner of WebEx, you should always be able to see the clock, at least in that view. And we, you know, I don't know that it would be a problem with the four or five screens that we have today, but I just want to make sure you're able to see the clock. And if you do have issues or questions, feel free to stop us, interrupt us. You don't get us, you don't hear us say that very often, but please interrupt us if there's something that that you're unable to participate for some reason, or if you can't see the clock. All right, with that, counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you.
All right, go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Abigail Rankin, and I represent appellant Ziddy Taylor in this matter. Mr. Taylor is a 35-year-old man who will spend the next 20 years of his life in prison as a result of the plea before you today. Today, you're not here to consider ineffective assistance of counsel, nor is the issue the constitutional validity of this plea. Rather, the issue before you today is whether the district court applied the proper standard when it denied Mr. Taylor's motion for plea withdrawal under Rule 1505, Subdivision 2. When Mr. Taylor testified about how he felt regarding his relationship with his attorneys, his trial attorneys, he said, quote, "I just felt like the attorneys, they weren't on my side. They weren't trying to hear nothing I was saying. They basically weren't working with me." And this impression of his was not new. He expressed at the initial, the primary motion, or the first motion to withdraw his plea in October 15, 2018, that he would like a new, he would like new counsel. There was a brief discussion about that with the court. He indicated perhaps someone could come up from Chicago. The court expressed concern that person would not be prepared. That was the last we heard of it on the record. But that indicates that from an early point in these proceedings, Mr. Taylor was in fact concerned with his representation. At the point of his plea, he was in this context. He had spent those fleeting months uncertain about his relationship with his attorneys, providing alibi information, potentially in October. It seems there might be a phone number in October. There might be a phone number in early January. It's not completely clear from the record, but providing alibi information nonetheless, hearing nothing about the investigation of that alibi information, and then watching his attorneys through 2 days of trial conduct only 35 pages worth of cross-examination over 353 pages worth of testimony. That includes minimal cross-examination of a witness who would place Mr. Taylor at the scene, an adult witness, no less. Mr. Taylor, after seeing these 2 days of trial, yes.
I mean, isn't it true the district court, after considering testimony at a hearing, made findings that the lawyers had made strategic decisions about how to cross-examine that witness. They were mindful of the advantages and disadvantages of various strategies and rather deliberately chose that strategy. Doesn't that limit district court's options then, or its analysis of what's fair and just thereafter?
It would if we were working under a constitutional invalidity standard here. Because we're looking at fair and just, Mr. Taylor's concerns don't need to rise to the same level as constitutional invalidity, which ineffective assistance of counsel would bring it to. The district court did analyze effective assistance of counsel and found that that did not support plea withdrawal. But again, that's the constitutional standard. That's the manifest injustice standard, which is much higher than the fair and just standard.
I would agree that issue normally comes into play. I mean, that type of analysis about strategic decisions by counsel often or normally comes into play with ineffective assistance claims. But isn't it also relevant to a fair and just analysis in this case?
Yes, it is relevant to an extent. But I think the focus here should have been instead not on whether counsel's actions were justified, but how they made Mr. Taylor feel, how they impacted his relationship with his counsel, whether he felt he'd be able to have any sort of fair trial at that point, which is clear he did not. Tice defines the fair and just standard as, on the one hand, more than nothing and less than constitutional invalidity. This is a very wide range.
So, Ms. Rankin, Judge yes. Riley here. So the judge did a chronology of your client's behaviors and requests during his various trials, and your client had been allowed to withdraw his plea once before. And then when trial started again or began in earnest, he kept saying, well, I want that deal. And the prosecutor would say, well, it's off the table because you didn't take it when you took it. And so at the end of the second day, after these children have testified and the eyewitness, Miss Williams, had testified and apparently, according to the judge's order, was scared to testify, your client then said, okay, well, I will plead guilty. Do you think that chronology has anything to do with what's fair and just in the fair and just analysis here?
I do think that's relevant. The reason that it is because it gives us insight into where Mr. Taylor's headspace was here and how much credibility we can give to his concerns with his relationship with counsel. I think the back and forth of these plea offers could go to show, this wasn't testified to, but it could go to show that Mr. Taylor was feeling desperate about his representation, but not desperate enough. Then after the weekend, February 1st and 2nd, I believe, January 31st and February 1st were the first 2 days of trial. Then there was a weekend. He sat in custody over that weekend, pondering how his counsel had represented him, how poorly he felt his relationship was proceeding with them, and then made the ultimate decision that, you know what, it's not worth it. I just need to take what I can.
Well, except the judge found that speculation on all of our parts, right? But that your client saw how the testimony went in, and he was then, because the witnesses were very credible, looking at a life without possibility of parole sentence if he were convicted, which was seemingly to get more and more likely. That's another way to look at it. At least that's how the district court looked at it.
Yes. I think, though, that even with those witnesses testifying credibly or not credibly and providing this evidence against him, making another higher sentence more likely, the issue remains that he's watching his counsel not cross-examine these credible damning witnesses, if you'll pardon my language. He's watching his counsel, in his experience, in his understanding, throw the case. That's what he thinks he's seeing. He doesn't understand why these witnesses aren't being cross-examined. We all understand the trial strategy of counsel here, but I don't believe that it was explained. No one ever testified that they explained it to Mr. Taylor so that he would understand what was going on and that there was something in his benefit underlying that decision.
Let's talk about the alibi witness, because the record, as you said earlier, only becomes clear about what happened in the weeks preceding the beginning of his actual trial. It isn't clear that in the months before that, that he ever gave his attorneys leads that they could credibly follow up on. Names, phone numbers, anything like that. It wasn't until right before trial that he provided a name and a number for this man who then, reluctant, doesn't even begin to describe how he refused to actually talk to your client's investigators. So what do we do with that alibi argument?
I think you look at that again, not under the lens of ineffective assistance of counsel, but under the lens of whether Mr. Taylor believed he would receive a fair trial here, how he believed that impacted his relationship with his attorneys and whether they were fighting for him. Though he may not have given them that information beforehand, he had discussed it previously. He didn't hear anything about it. At one point, I believe it was in October, he gave some unidentified information. I believe Mr. Benson initially testified that it was a name and a phone number, but then later testified they didn't receive that until January. He gave some sort of identifying information in October. And then I think it was about a month later, spoke with Mr. Benson, who said, "You didn't give me that information. I don't remember that." And then Mr. Benson remembered and sent him a letter, called him, spoke with him and said, "Yeah, I do remember that now." That lapse in memory for something that to Mr. Taylor seems crucial, even though he doesn't know they can't investigate without that more information, that lapse in memory just goes to show for him, his attorneys aren't working with him. They're not trying to hear what he has to say.
So would you agree that this case, for our purposes, turns on whether we, in a way, affirm, or I guess I should say, turns on how we review this adverse credibility determination that the district court made? If you look at the district court's order, it's pretty strong language. This defies credulity. The purported alibi defense was little more than a conjectural Hail Mary desperation ploy. If the district court at the end of the day denied the motion because it just didn't believe that Taylor really did lose confidence, and because it just didn't believe that Taylor had this alibi defense or had done what he should have done to communicate that, that's essentially an adverse credibility determination that is the basis for the denial. And if that's what we're looking at, and would you agree that that's what we're looking at? And if so, doesn't that affect our review today?
Given that the standard is abuse of discretion, it certainly does affect your review what the district court's findings were, especially with regard to fact witnesses. However, the district court also in his order on, I believe, page 18, wrote, "It may be the case that Taylor subjectively lacked confidence in Monsieur Benson's attorney." The district court was saying he objectively did not agree with Mr. Taylor's characterization of his relationship with his attorney's practice. But that's not the question here. The question isn't objective, did they do the right thing? The question is subjective, is it fair and just? How did Mr. Taylor feel about this? Your analysis, I believe, instead turns more closely on how you believe the district court analyzed this evidence. The standard that the district court applied is nothing if not convoluted. In its conclusions of law, it combines ineffective assistance and fair and just together, raising the fair and just standard to a constitutional level. On page 18 of its order, the judge rejects ineffective assistance and finds prejudice to the state, combining those two standards once more. And on page 21, the court comes out and says that Mr. Taylor's burden is to prove his guilty plea was invalid and that withdrawal of his guilty plea is fair and just. This is an inaccurate statement of the standard. It's an abuse of discretion to misapply a standard per QBUS. And it colored the entire analysis from the district court. When fair and just comes up in his order, it comes up in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel or constitutional invalidity. Pages 18, 21, and 32 all bring up fair and just in the context of those constitutional issues. But that impermissibly raises the standard of fair and just up to that constitutional level of manifest injustice, which it simply is not.
Is it wrong to consider prejudice to the state or having to call those witnesses a second time?
It's certainly not
fair and just standard.
Certainly not wrong to consider prejudice to the state. In fact, the district court has to consider prejudice to the state under the fair and just standard. However, the state bears the burden of proving not just prejudice, but undue prejudice. And at this hearing, at the evidentiary hearing, the only thing the state said about its burden was that it would be a travesty to allow this plea withdrawal to proceed. The state did not argue our children have gone to the wind, we can't find them to testify, or they would be additionally traumatized, we're concerned for that. They didn't argue the case is getting stale. In fact, it wasn't because the plea withdrawal motion was made so closely to that plea. They didn't argue anything about whether they would be or how this delay would impact their ability to prove their case. The district court made some findings on that based on the record, but again, it's the state's burden to meet that proof, and they didn't present any argument at all.
Could you remind me again the reasons for his earlier motion to withdraw, which was granted, and were they similar to the reasons underlying this motion, or were they different?
They were quite distinct. The first motion to withdraw was based on the fact that his plea had contemplated, the negotiation had contemplated a specific bottom of the box score for criminal history score of 3. I'm sorry, bottom of the box sentence for criminal history score of 3. The PSI came back, he had a criminal history score of 2, which moved the bottom of the box sentence down by a fair number of months to 295. Mr. Taylor asked the state if they would agree to move forward with that sentence, the 295, in keeping with the bottom of the box agreement, and the state refused. When the district court found this out, the district court said, you know, I don't want to deal with a criminal history score impact on the plea validity. I'm going to let him withdraw this plea, and the state didn't contest that. The initial plea withdrawal, I would argue, is on the state and not on Mr. Taylor. With that in mind, seeing no further questions at this point, I would ask that you reverse the order denying Mr. Taylor's motion for plea withdrawal, remand this matter for further consideration. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Volks.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Sarah Volks, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm appellant's convictions because the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's motion to withdraw his plea. Appellant did not establish any legal reasons why it would be fair and just to allow him to withdraw his plea. Plea negotiations involve a careful calculus by both sides about the weight of the evidence, the risks of trial, the gains and concessions to be made by both parties. Here, appellant entered a valid guilty plea midway through a jury trial. To allow appellant to withdraw his plea would undermine the integrity of the plea-taking process. At the outset, I'd like to address the issue of whether the district court used the correct standard in its order and memorandum.
Before we get there, I want to ask a little bit about the timing of the plea. There are lots of judges who would say that they're not going to accept a plea after a certain point. Certainly after trial has begun, I think judges can do that. But in this case, that didn't happen. The judge did accept this plea mid-trial. And are you saying that there's some limitations to what the judge can do after that? Or that there was something wrong by allowing the parties to enter a plea at this point in the trial?
No, I don't think that there was anything wrong with the district court accepting a plea negotiation at that time. You know, it's obviously less common that once a jury trial starts that maybe it doesn't proceed all the way to verdict, but it's certainly not unheard of that cases will resolve either during jury selection or at some point during the trial. I think especially with a case that is as serious as a murder case, that if the two parties can come to an agreement, I know that from the state's perspective, the certainty of a guilty plea would certainly be something that the state would be interested in accepting or you know, moving forward with a negotiation on a case that's this serious. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with the district court entertaining a plea negotiation even during trial. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. I can start with the issue of whether the district court used the correct standard. First of all, I think it's important to note that the argument below was that appellant's plea was involuntary because of his counsel's performance. In the transcript of the evidentiary hearing, there's the explanation of the argument sort of shifts over time, but at the conclusion of that hearing, his attorney does argue for sort of the Strickland standard, which is that the performance of counsel fell below objective reasonableness, and that but for those errors, his client would not have pled guilty. And so that is making an argument of sort of the constitutional level of ineffective assistance of counsel, which would render his plea constitutionally invalid. And so at the outset, that's why the court spends so much time analyzing whether or not there's ineffective assistance of counsel. Obviously, at this juncture, both sides agree that there's not ineffective assistance of counsel. However, that is why the bulk of the memorandum is analyzing that particular issue. And we see this in appellate cases as well. Even if it's a fair and just standard, if ineffective assistance of counsel has been met, then by function of law, obviously the lesser standard is met as well. Additionally, I think with a careful review of Judge Karasov's order, it's clear that the judge is considering the fair and just standard. The argument wasn't presented to Judge Karasov in quite the same way that it is here, that we have a subjective lack of confidence that doesn't rise to ineffective assistance of counsel and isn't rising to the constitutional invalidity, but is instead some sort of lesser fair and justice standard. And so since the argument wasn't presented in that exact same way, we don't see Judge Karasov analyzing whether this subjective lack of confidence would meet fair and just. However, in carefully reviewing his order, he does lay out the two different standards. He does acknowledge fair and just is a lesser standard than manifest injustice. He does then, I think a critical part of his order is after the lengthy analysis of ineffective assistance of counsel, the last few pages, the district court assesses appellant's credibility. And I know that that was brought up earlier in this argument. So he assesses his credibility and the district court concludes that the appellant, he does not believe that the reason the appellant pled guilty was because of this subjective lack of confidence. Then furthermore, the end of the district court's order lays out the chronology. And so this is the entire context in which the plea occurred. And there are other appellate cases such as State versus Lopez and State versus Abdisalan that both uphold this concept that the district court is looking at the entire context in which an appellant's plea of guilty occurred as demonstrated by the record. And so the state would argue that these last two portions of the district court's memorandum, where the court addresses the credibility, the entire context, and then concludes that based on the totality of the circumstances that the fair and just standard has not been met, that the district court did not abuse its discretion because it both analyzed ineffective assistance of counsel as well as the other circumstances that could lead to the fair and just standard being met. Additionally, it's the state's position that the appellant did not establish any reasons why it would be fair and just to withdraw his plea. I know that in appellant's reply brief, those reasons are distilled to the following, that the appellant felt his attorneys were not dedicated to him. He thought trial wouldn't be fair because of that, and that he felt like he had no choice. And so from the state's perspective, essentially, since ineffective assistance of counsel meets the manifest injustice standard, here we're being asked to find some sort of lesser degree of representation to meet the fair and just standard. And in the state's view, legally, there is either ineffective assistance of counsel or there is not. There's not a gradient of the type of representation in which some of it's manifest injustice and some of it is fair and just. Furthermore, to adopt the rule that appellant is suggesting would allow for liberal withdrawal of pleas. Any appellant could withdraw his plea prior to sentencing with such a subjective standard. And especially this would be true in cases where defendants have pleaded guilty to very serious cases with lengthy prison sentences. The odds that they might have some dissatisfaction with the system are greater. So to adopt such a rule would certainly destabilize plea negotiations. Furthermore, I would point this court to State versus Abdisalan, the 2003 Court of Appeals case that I cited in my brief. In that case, the appellant there raised some of the same concerns as here. I think that the facts are analogous. There, that particular defendant felt like he was alone. He felt like his attorney was against him, as well as the prosecutor and the judge. He felt alone in the system and felt like he had no choice but to plead guilty. And there, the Court of Appeals found that this was not enough to reverse a district court's denial of a plea withdrawal motion. There, I would note that there were even additional facts that that particular defendant was concerned about prejudice against Muslim immigrants in the wake of 9/11, that English was not his first language. He had entered a Norgard plea. But even with those additional facts above and beyond what we have here, the Court of Appeals did not find that the district court abused its discretion in denying that motion. So I think that that particular case is helpful here because it certainly hints at the type of dissatisfaction that is being alleged here by this appellant. Finally, I would like to spend some time talking about the prejudice to the state in this case. And there are three main things I'd like to point out to the court when it comes to this issue of prejudice. First of all, and I think this is incredibly important, the standard is not undue prejudice. Appellant misstates the standard, in particular in the reply brief, where undue prejudice is repeated throughout the reply brief with emphasis. However, Rule 1505 states that the court has to give due consideration to both the reasons advanced by the defendant in support of the motion, as well as any prejudice the granting of the motion would cause the prosecution by reason of actions taken in reliance upon defendant's plea. So the phrase is any prejudice, not unduly prejudicial or undue prejudice. The State versus Riley case does not use the phrase undue prejudice. Once again, it's just considering prejudice to the state. Where the phrase undue prejudice appears to come from is the State versus Wolkowitz case. However, I would point out that that case is not a case that's about the fair and just standard. That particular case is after sentencing. It's in this context where a district court did not impose initially the mandatory conditional release period on a sex offender. And so that case is not the framework of the fair and just standard. And so to raise this prejudice to undue prejudice is not what the language of Rule 15 is, and that is not the appropriate standard. The second point I would like to make about the prejudice to the state is that State versus Riley does not stand for the proposition that the type of prejudice the state is alleging here is not prejudice at all. A careful reading of that case indicates that the district or the Minnesota Supreme Court thought the prejudice was overstated in that particular case, but that case doesn't stand for the proposition that the state in this instance has not experienced any prejudice. I think more importantly, the facts of Riley are distinguishable in that there the plea did not occur midway through trial. Here, appellant's second guilty plea happened after the state had put on the bulk of its case, 20 witnesses, nearly 200 exhibits. And the third point I want to make about prejudice is that State versus Kaiser is really important to consider here. That case acknowledges the prejudice in essentially this exact same scenario. And that case was a criminal sexual conduct case where the guilty plea occurred after the state had put in the bulk of its case. And that's where the strong language from the Minnesota Supreme Court comes from, where the court said, in our view, it would be an extremely rare case where we would reverse the trial court's discretionary refusal to allow a withdrawal under the fair and just standard, where the guilty plea the defendant wants to withdraw is one that was entered in the middle of a rape trial after the complainant has testified and the state has nearly completed its case. What that description is prejudice to the state. And so although that phrase isn't used there, when you read the entirety of the opinion, that is what's being considered there, that it is apparent and obvious what the prejudice to the state would be in a case such as this, where the state subpoenaed the case a first time, subpoenaed the case a second time, and actually went to trial. And as the Rule 15 states, it's the prejudice that the state has suffered in reliance on the plea. And here, as the district court found in its order and is apparent in the record without further argument really from the state, is that the only reason the trial stopped and didn't go to verdict was because the appellant wished to enter a guilty plea. I think the other final point that, one of the final points I would like to make is that Justice Brian, you brought up that that the district court made credibility determinations in this case. And I think that that's really critical here, which is that the district court, upon the entire context of the record and upon seeing the appellant testify himself at this evidentiary hearing, did not find it credible, did not believe that the reason that appellant withdrew his plea or that appellant pled guilty was due to his feelings about his counsel. And I think that there's support in case law, for instance, State versus Jones, which is cited in the state's briefing as well, which indicates that this court would defer to those types of credibility determinations.
In order to reverse, is it necessary for us to reach an alternate or a contrary conclusion about credibility, or is it enough to say this is a subjective belief and we can't undermine or we can't say that subjective belief is incorrect?
Right. I think it would be difficult for this court to make a different credibility determination since this court didn't see the testimony. But if this court wanted to adopt a new rule of law that this subjective lack of confidence in and of itself establishes the fair and just standard, this court could adopt a new rule of law in that regard. And I see that my time is up. And so I'll just say in conclusion that the state respectfully requests that this court hold the district court did not abuse its discretion and that this court affirm his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rankin.
I'm not advocating. Oh, am I unmuted now? Uh-oh, now I can't hear.
Go ahead. I think, yep.
Good. Okay.
We missed the very beginning of your statement. Why don't you start over?
Thank you. I'm not advocating a new rule of law here. I'm not advocating that this court blanketly state that any lack of confidence in counsel is sufficient for plea withdrawal. In this particular case, our argument is that Mr. Taylor presented sufficient evidence to support his argument. Though the district court did receive argument characterized as ineffective assistance of counsel by defense counsel, the district court's still duty bound to consider both standards and analyze the facts present before the court. Though the state argues that there's either ineffective assistance of counsel or there's not, that doesn't comport with the existence of a manifest injustice standard. It doesn't seem logical that if it doesn't rise all the way to that constitutional level, which may I remind includes or doesn't even include falling asleep in court during trial, if it doesn't rise to that level, it doesn't impact the plea's validity. And that seems improper given this fair and just standard and the distinction between the two. I would like to focus a little bit on Raleigh. The prejudice discussed in that case, though the procedural posture may be different, is still quite illuminating. In Raleigh, the Supreme Court found insufficient prejudice after 16 months had elapsed since the crime was committed. Two witnesses had died. The state had shifted its investigation to someone else's case. Witnesses were expected to become uncooperative, and the state had stopped looking for additional witnesses. the court found the state didn't satisfy its burden of proof there. If that's not prejudice, I don't know how what we have here is. I'd also like to distinguish Kaiser. Kaiser, though the Supreme Court did make that comment, it didn't make any findings on the fair and just standard. What Kaiser did was say, you didn't have an evidentiary hearing. You need to go back and have this evidentiary hearing. They didn't say, this isn't fair and just. They didn't say, you should find this. They said, please have an evidentiary hearing and consider it there. Kaiser doesn't stand for the proposition that this kind of procedural posture precludes plea withdrawal. Additionally, there are some meaningful fact differences between here and Kaiser. Kaiser was based on, or the Kaiser court's comments were based on the fact that the 16-year-old rape victim had testified already. Here, we are not dealing with a direct witness. Though there were people there at the offense in the immediate vicinity, they turned around and saw Mr. Taylor at the time, according to their testimony, they didn't see this happen. There's no information, no allegation that these kids would be traumatized by describing again that they believe they heard fireworks and turned around and saw Mr. Taylor. There's no evidence in the record to support that claim. It cannot be used to show prejudice. I'd also like to briefly note that the court applied the wrong standard. The district court here looked at ineffective assistance of counsel, focused in on ineffective assistance of counsel, and did not consider Mr. Taylor's arguments under a different lens. It is possible to do so with a constitutional claim. I believe it was, excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry. It was Abdusalan. Yes, it was Abdusalan. They're considering the lack of evidence of coercion there. That would render a plea involuntary if it were all the way to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel, coercive assistance of counsel. But they considered it under the fair and just standard, showing that there is, in fact, some possibility that counsel's behavior can rise to a fair and just or can meet the fair and just burden without rising all the way to the level of constitutional ineffective assistance of counsel. I see my time is running out. If there are no additional questions, I would ask this court to please reverse the order denying Mr. Taylor's plea withdrawal motion and remand this for consideration under the proper fair and just standard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your briefs and your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. Have a nice day.
Thank you as well.